Welcome back to Almost Famous Minute, where we're discussing the 2000 Cameron Crowe film, Almost Famous, 1 minute at a time. I'm Eric Nash from Feels Like Weezer.
And I'm Mike Jozek from For Your Consideration and a podcast named Scooby-Doo.
Yeah, Mike, great to have you back. How you been?
It's good to be back.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, it's just you and I this time, and you can kind of be considered a co-host slash guest.
Woo-woo, promotion.
Yeah, that's what other people have talked about. There's no actual pay increase, though. I'll double your pay. I'll triple it. Things times zero are still zero. It's a joke. Math jokes. Wonderful. It's been quite a few weeks, maybe a couple few months even, since I think you're last on with good old Dave. This is minute 88 today, and it starts with Leslie learning the truth and ends with Penny, then William leaving. So they're in this restaurant we've talked about last 2 or 3 minutes, I think, here. Max's Kansas City. Was it steak, lobster, and chickpeas?
Basically guaranteed to have a brush with greatness every time you go in.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. You know much about it?
Just from listening to the commentary with Cameron Crowe and his mom, and he was talking about there's a number of places kind of along the coastline where you could basically go there. They were hot spots for, bands touring and stuff. I think he said I think it was the Regency Hyatt or maybe just the Hyatt.
Yeah.
Lobby was one of them. And Max's Kansas City was another one. He talked about his own experience there with Lou Reed, where he kind of embarrassed himself being a big fan of Lou Reed, and Lou Reed just kind of like shooed him away.
Lou, I guess, would do that to you, you know?
Well, to be fair...
He's not too coddling of a type of person, didn't seem like.
I mean, Cameron, I think, was still fairly young at the time, and he went up to him, and he was like, "Hey, Lou Reed, you're awesome. Do you know I got an article on Rolling Stone? They're giving me the cover. It's Jackson Brown. I wrote that."
Uh-oh. I can see Lou going on not being too agreeable at that point when bringing up someone like Jackson Brown to him.
Yeah, I don't know much about the places like now, contemporary, as far as contemporary.
Yeah,
like,
I think we had, even last, well, actually, I think it's at this point, I think I'm taking the week. I've just come back from taking last week off. But 2 weeks ago, we had our crazy little April Fool's Day prank, jokey thing going on with the great people from This Means Something, the Close Encounters a Minute, essentially. Chris and Tierney. And what they had to say, I think they had some interesting things to say about the place. And even the week before that, Joe and I. Joe had some thoughts too, but there's certain aspects of the way it looks. It's like it's kind of on a plain side. I would think it would be a little bit more dressed up, but it wouldn't be any kind of quite as craziness as we're used to from the 90s on. I think roughly maybe with the Hard Rock Cafe or even your typical like Max and Irma's Outback or any of those with all the stuff that they put on their walls. But this is a lot plainer, and it's also a lot, a bit quieter in a sense, I think, as far as, like, music playing. We did seem to have some diegetic music in the director's cut, the untitled, that I talked about with Joe. I think Chris and Tierney didn't even talk about the music that was on in the background, very light, which Joe and I also talked about a little bit. That was Free's Wishing Well. But, that's gone away, I think, a little bit at last minute. And at this minute, we do have this very important song for these next 2.5 minutes, roughly, I think, of Elton John's Mona Lisa's and Mad Hatter's. But we clearly find out, I think, essentially next minute, which I'll say it now, it's not diegetic. It is not in the scene. It is clearly we continue to hear. I mean, maybe it could be diegetic, but it becomes not diegetic. That's for damn sure.
not diegetic, but thematically relevant.
Oh my god, yeah. I mean, yeah, some of the stuff I have to say about that, especially next minute, a little bit this minute, I think, but we can find some things, but I think the next minute when we have a dialogue-less minute, yeah, it's even more spot on some of the choices that I think Cameron makes in the interesting editing that happens as well. And I think we even get a little bit of that. Okay. But yeah, so I mean, it's all starting with Leslie, you know, that, and I've been going on crazy about her for the past 5 minutes or so, or maybe even before that, before she actually showed up, I knew, I was mentioning that she was coming up, that she was going to appear, and it's Russell, and because she was being talked about, Russell's ex-wife, now girlfriend, maybe to be wife again, maybe fiance or something. I don't know exactly for sure the exact status, but you know, it's she's played by Liz Stauber. I don't even know how much I'd said that before, and just a little bit, she even reminded me a little bit of, in watching this minute especially, the lead actress in Inside Llewyn Davis, who is that Carrie Mulligan. If you've seen that, yeah, I was like, oh, I'm getting some vibes from her, especially this minute, I think, with what she says here at the very beginning.
I always got such a, like, she doesn't have a large role, but she's got a really strong presence in the film.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And there's kind of this Maris vibe, like from Frasier.
Yeah. Wow.
Because, like, she's really, what's the word I'm looking for? People kind of fear her a little bit.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And she kind of doesn't fit sort of the rock and roll lifestyle, but, you know, she's obviously somebody that is there and in it, and Russell fell in love with her, and Jeffrey fell in love with her. And
yeah. We don't know that. We don't really know that yet.
Oh, we don't know that yet, yeah. No. Although there is, no, there is the look that Jeff gives her near the end of the minute. But
yeah. Yeah, that's true. Mm.
She's got a coldness to her, and there's this, you know, gravity to her, and I mean, so much of this minute in general is about faces and expressions and looks, but she to me feels like the center of gravity in a way to the whole scene.
Because, she's a black hole.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Sucking all the light in.
And there's kind of this attempt at some joyousness and celebration because of, you know, they're having fun. They're having dinner at Max's. And then there's the whole idea of getting the cover. But none of that outweighs her presence and the fact that Russell's there and Penny's there and Leslie's there.
Yeah, and I think one thing I'd want to point out, you know, it's the fourth one in the IMDb known fours. You know, the third one is Three Kings, which I know I definitely saw that at least the one time, you know, probably on video, you know, on video the year after it came out. I wasn't in theaters at that point in 99, a whole bunch. The 4 years later after this in 2004, The Village, which I just rewatched again. I mean, I really love that movie. But she's playing one of the characters, probably one of the, well, not kid. She's 4 years past this, but Beatrice, whichever character that is, I don't know all the names of the characters that well, but it's hard enough to wrap in your head around a bit about trying to think about. But yeah, I mean, it's just, I hadn't really talked much. I don't think we had gone into much about her really, the actress, but that's what I got for this one, I think, at this point.
As far as the actor?
Yeah, yeah.
I like her. I like what she brings to it. It's something that I really like about a lot of the characters in the film who just have these bit parts, like even a bit part in a Crow film is still like a real human being, and they're memorable. Like they're only there for a few minutes, but they're not just background.
Until they are, kind of, with a little bit. I will mention two things from last minute that I wish I kind of got to talk a little bit about and didn't. I certainly heard plenty about, they talked about the Beatles a good bit, the comparison that Jeff makes, and they worked through that pretty well. I like that a lot. I got to edit that episode as well, just so y'all know out there. I didn't get to hear it for the first time on my own. That would have been really trippy and weird. But the other thing is, you mentioning background really brings it to mind is in that minute, Beth from Denver is standing there next to Penny for the, you know, briefest of a shot, and then she's gone. Like it zooms out, you know, after cutting back to William or Russell, one of the two, for just a second or so, it zooms out. It goes back to a more zoomed out shot, and Beth from Denver is gone. She's out of the frame that quickly somehow. But I really don't think we see her again either. You know, she's very, you know, her and that Estrella, they both kind of replaced each other, I think, at different points, because I think she does come back in a little bit. But so one of the huge things here is Leslie says she's not with any of you guys, is she? So she's the last minute she said, who is that girl? And that's the one other thing. I almost was sure that Tierney would have, because she even says it for like the starts and ends with or something, and maybe and Leslie saying who is that girl makes me think of Madonna. But I thought Tierney was going to say that, but maybe she's just not as into Madonna in that. And that was a big movie for her as well.
It was huge, yeah.
Back in the 80s, really propelled her even more so than just her music. But so then in my transcript that I gave to you, Mike, I said every guy says, yeah, she's with me. In my own, in taking notes, I had to note, except Russell. And that's the awful thing that happens here, you know. Between every other guy saying that, and then realizing they just all screwed up, Russell is the one that doesn't say it.
I mean, theoretically, yeah. He shouldn't be saying it anyways.
Yeah. It could have just been a little bit of honesty from him, maybe.
It's one of those cases where like. The silence is deafening.
and Dick, I mean, it's like you just like you see this profile of him, and he puts his fingers to like the sides of his nose. And I don't know if that's a Coke thing, but maybe. But it's to me, it's just like, oh shit, I gotta go clean this up, kind of.
Yeah.
Gesture, and that's when he gets up and. Whew. And also at this point, Mona Lisa's and Mad Hatter's, I mean, really just like 6 seconds in. I mean, it starts in and you know, it's right in on a lyric that isn't the start of the song. You know, it's like I was saying a few minutes ago, that Cameron really does some interesting things. Somehow Cameron or someone else on his team, whatever, editing, audio editing, just really does a pretty crazy job of getting the right or certain lyrics, you know, to be being sung from the music at the right times, fitting sometimes with things that are going on. And it's just amazing what they do, how they cut up the song.
I had forgotten that song was in this scene, and when I sat down to watch these minutes, it was a really pleasant surprise, because Mona Lisa's and Mad Hatter's is probably my favorite Elton John song.
Yeah, that's why I was coming to and rewatching these minutes over and over again. Like, okay, I have to listen to the whole song at least once here before I come on. I'm like, this is such a great song. It takes the cake. I mean, as far as just the song on its own, takes the cake. Over from Tiny Dancer and many other, I think. I mean, the only thing that I think could give it a run for me would be like, you know, Funeral for a Friend, Love Lies Sleep Bleeding, which is his most progressive, I think, sound probably. But it's as a simple, you know, verse, chorus, verse, you know, straight ahead kind of song, you know, mostly piano, and we get something else coming in next minute, so may save that. But
it's also interesting to note
it's become my favorite just by doing this.
As of I think he said in the commentary they started doing it on Jerry Maguire. I know there's a number of filmmakers who will play music on set while people are acting. And he said they actually used Mona Lisa's and Mad Hatter's for this scene.
Wow.
So Kate is actually acting to Mona Lisa's and Mad Hatter's. And yeah.
So yeah, so her acting here gets crazy because, you know, Dick is saying something to her. He must, I mean, yeah, you want to take give a take as to what you think he must be saying to get these reactions from her?
Well, I get the feeling he's probably just being very politic and telling her that, you know, she has to leave because Leslie's there and it's awkward and whatever. And
yeah,
I mean, you kind of see a little bit of playful defiance in Penny's face. You kind of see a little bit of incredulousness. You kind of see that she wants to stir up some crap. I can't remember if we can swear on your show.
Oh, no, yeah, you're fine.
You can tell she kind of wants to stir up some shit because, you know, Russell's her guy. And she's kind of being spurned here and she doesn't like it. And I can't guess as to what Dick actually says, but you know Dick's kind of a stand-up guy, if maybe a little clumsy and obtuse at times. But, you know, he is the guy that got up to go and handle the situation.
It wasn't Dennis, their new guy.
So,
Dick, you get to deal with this stuff. I'll handle the floorboards.
Yeah. So I think it's, yeah, I can't imagine that he's like telling her to get lost, but he's probably saying like, this isn't a good time.
Wow. See, I was thinking, you know, I mean, I think he might've been saying though, Russell doesn't love you. He can't love you. He's going to do this with his wife, you know, continue on. And I mean,
that could be a legit interpretation too. Cause I mean, he could also be saying that out of a, you know, when a friend tells somebody a hard truth.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So he could be telling her that in a way, you know, that's like, it's not like Russell doesn't love you. Get lost. You skank.
Yeah.
but like you have to stop hanging around cause he doesn't love you. Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah, well, I certainly appreciate your initial thoughts.
This kind of ties into, in a way, just in the fact that we have a couple interpretations here of sort of Dick's position. The last minutes that I was on, where Dick did the introduction and we were kind of trying to figure out, you know, did he know or did he not know about the other manager? And like, just kind of trying to read Dick's behavior. And I think all three of us had a slightly different take on it could be. Yeah. So, maybe Dick's a complicated guy.
So part of the lyric here that's happening, I think at this point is, you know, people run you through. I think that's maybe tied in, you know, and looking at it in this minute by minute way, you know, made me realize that. And it's Penny's reaction here, but it's also later that is informing me of this my take on that. So it's so we'll get to that one in a moment or in a couple weeks, essentially. So then we you know, we got Jeff's, you know, saying, so who's going to shoot it? And there's even all these great eye looks back and forth, eye acting, you know, between William and Russell, and then Jeff even kind of wraps it up. There is a standing up though too, parts that first William and then Russell, but who's gonna shoot it? And then I gave you my takes. Just these two different sentences of or two different lines. I think that they could both be from the same person, but they might be from different people. I'm not sure. Maybe Dick in there, but Dick is Dick back? No, yeah, he's already. Yeah, he's gone, and I don't know. Dick, but you know, almost assuredly this is Dennis. I mean, you even see him kind of gesticulating a little bit there at one point. But you know, in response to Jeff, who's gonna shoot it, you know, I love Annie Leibovitz or Neil Preston. And there was a weird in the transcript I got and then I edit and give out to my guests, I put in Neil Preston. There was some other verbiage there that was like, oh, that the person who wrote this just does not know who Neil Preston is at that point when they typed it, because he's become much more known, I think, amongst fans of this movie, and especially like if you listen to WTF, Mark Maron's podcast, and got some good stuff on Cameron Crowe and some behind the scenes knowledge. But you know, and one of the crazy things for that is that, you know, Anne Leibovitz is great, and she's at this point, I mean, man, at this point, I forget if she did the initial John Lennon, Yoko Ono photos, but she definitely did the ones at the end of the 70s there, right in 80,
yeah,
even right before his death, I believe. But
I don't know who the big Rolling Stone photographers were at the time.
Yeah. Mm. But Cameron definitely puts these two names in. I mean, they're really huge now, at least as of 2000. I mean, they had gotten a lot bigger, well, better than I. But Neil Preston, I mean, Anne Leibovitz is definitely more the cover type of a photographer in my mind, whereas Neil Preston is just so much more of a live in the act of performance kind of photographer for the bands. And so it would have been a weird thing, I think, if you know, because it seems like so many of the cover shoots are done on, you know, with a made up backdrop or what have you, you know, in a studio. But it's just hard to see that happening for Neil. But it's a great little shout out he gives, actually almost more of a behind the scene whisper, you know, practically. It's that low key in the mix at this point. Yeah.
His wiki page says that in 71 he moved to LA, and that's kind of where he started doing a lot of the rock photography and whatnot. So the timing of it works out.
Yeah, I think, you know, yeah. I'm sure they were both working at this point, but just were they really would they really have been in contention? and Dennis Hope knowing them well enough at that point to suggest that this could be the case, that they would be the possible likely cover photographers.
Yeah. It might also be significant that he was actually like an on-set photographer for this film.
Oh yeah, that's for sure. Yeah, right.
So yeah,
okay. Yeah. This film and many others right around this period, and more shortly after them, before Elizabethtown.
And this film features so many either shout outs or actual like physical cameos of people.
Yeah, Peter Frampton.
And even
Cameron Crowe's mother in the deleted scene, but she does come back shortly in a few minutes. We hear her just a little bit, not as much as we do in that scene, I think. But and so then someone else, I think, possibly, but maybe also still, Dennis continues on to say, you know, he said, "I love Anne Leibovitz or Neil Preston," or I maybe it's "I'd love," you know, essentially trying to say "I'd love for either of them to be the photographers." But then he seems to continue saying, "I love Annie's stuff. She does great stuff," you know. So, but it's getting to be so low in the mix and so forth. And there's even more after that that I just could not have the heart to try and listen to, you know, volume cranked. It would have been really tough to try to make out unless you tried and succeeded. But I gave you the transcript and.
Yeah, I didn't.
No,
I didn't try to. Yeah, I read it, I watched it, but I didn't do the forensic work.
Oh, sure. Oh, no, that's fine. Yeah, and you know, hey, it just continues on with the Elton John singing and these great interactions back and forth. Just, you know, like I say, and Penny just getting so upset, you know, and, you know, for you know, the line in the lyric, and it's in the title, the Mad Hatter's parts, and then Sons of Bankers, Sons of Lawyers. Are we trying to equate that madness and these people, the sons of these types of people that would do crazy things or something, maybe?
I wonder if I commented that so much of this scene and the next scene, well, a little bit of it in the next scene, is a lot of like face acting and non-dialogue, you know, emoting, And of course, Mona Lisa is famous for basically that mysterious smile, the mysterious look. Mm-hmm. Cool. I wonder.
Oh, cool. Can I? Yeah.
I wonder if that's digging too deep or if that's.
Yeah, like I said, I think the way he edited the music is just, I mean, you know, based on the lyrics and what was happening in the lyrics with what we see, I think it's important.
And I think I kind of put the minute on loop after we talked about Dick and Penny. And seeing the tail end of that again, she does get pretty upset. So I think you might be right. I think he probably... There was the resistance and Penny kind of being playful about it. And he probably just broke it down.
Yeah. It's not the first thing he says to her, but because he's wanting her to leave, you know, as he would prefer it. I think if she had just left as soon as he got there, you know, practically, you know, if she had left in the same manner that we just barely see at the end of the minute, you know, her starting to run essentially. Well, I mean, she runs away from where they're standing, but then the very last second is like a blurry image of.
He has to say something that upsets her enough that she leaves the way she does. So, yeah, I think I was maybe looking at that with a little too much of the rose-colored glasses, or maybe focusing too much on the playfulness of the initial interaction.
And I think that like I was talking about a little bit about the simpleness, maybe-ish, what have you, of this restaurant, the interior finishes of the restaurant, this reddish color that's mainly there. I mean, there's this, like, the wood paneling for the bottom half of the walls, but very, very 70s, that's for damn sure. I think, and last week, or 2 weeks ago, that is, Chris and Tierney, I mean, they, and James even was their guest. You know, they talked a bit about this dress that she's wearing, Penny's wearing, and is kind of, you know, blue on the lighter side of just the, you know, normal straight blue. And, you know, I think, again, this is matching, like, these lyrics so well. You know, he's talking, you know, he's saying, say good morning to the night, for unless they see the sky, you know. And so I just feel like this is so intentional that he goes, I need a light bluish, slightly light bluish dress for her to wear.
It's also interesting to note that Penny is wearing a light blue dress and Leslie is wearing dark blue. Mm-hmm. And Penny is blonde and Leslie has black hair.
Yeah.
And Penny smiles and Leslie scowls. They're kind of like, not mirror images, but like the opposite.
Yeah, right. Within a certain framework of women that Russell might be attracted to, say they're on the opposite ends of that context. What have?
But that dress really does have that dress really does make Kate stand out in that crowd scene too, because there is a lot of neutral colors and blacks and browns and some reds and stuff, and that blue just pops. Like you look across that room. And your eye zeroes in on her immediately. You're not like scanning the background. You're not being distracted by any kind of movement or whatever.
Well, watching it minute by minute, I sure was. I was distracted, like I was mentioning last minute, and there was Beth from Denver there. Well, in this minute, when Penny leaves, this other woman that's been kind of behind her somewhat for most of the time, most of the shots, this kind of almost little bit tiger stripey kind of dress that she's wearing. And she's similar to Beth in this kind of longer reddish hair, I think, too. But definitely not Beth. Beth had this more like a yellowy kind of jacket on, brief second or two that we saw her. Crazily, this other woman in this tiger stripe dress, she leaves right behind Penny. So it's almost like they were together. And maybe Beth was, too. Maybe Beth kind of left, too. But they, you know, as we'll find out next minute, it doesn't seem like any of them are together after this anymore. It's really kind of odd, a little bit odd that they decided to throw Beth in there. But there was also the, again, the director's cut, Untitled, where I talked about the couple minutes ago, that Plexia was there in this, not sitting down at the table, but here in this restaurant, and had this interaction with William, and she ends up leaving. Like we hear Penny again a little bit saying, Polixia, in the theatrical cut, Penny saying, Polixia is with, I think, off to England.
I do actually like that addition.
Yeah.
I have the untitled, well,
yeah, DVD and the Blu-ray. Commentary, yeah, too.
So because I was popping that in for the commentary, I decided to kind of watch a little bit before to lead into it, and pretty much watched right to the end of the movie.
Oh, sure.
It's one of those movies that once I put it in, like, it's hard to stop. But, it is nice because you kind of get a goodbye to that character and, you know, among other things, like, that she did with Will.
Yeah, right.
They're of a similar age and they kind of have a bond. And
they really did seem
so. And that ties in again to what I was talking about with, like, there's no small roles in this movie, right? Like, that scene has weight to me, and it's important to me to know what happens to these characters as they come in and out. You're happy to see them when they reappear. A lot of director's cuts, a lot of extended cuts are literally just like, here's all the stuff that we cut out. Now we can do it because we have the DVD or it's streaming or whatever. Mm-hmm. But this is a movie where I feel like none of those details bog it down.
No, yeah.
Like, it was literally just, I think, trimmed for theatrical run, and then everything else is just texture now that it's back in.
Yeah, and like I said before, I mean, Cameron chose to cut it, or chose to shoot everything that was in his script, at least every bit of dialogue, I would say, is right.
Yeah.
Based on Steven Spielberg's advice, suggestion, you know, and I think that, that untitled cut, indicates that it's nice that he did that. It's a lot of extra, a lot of nice extra stuff that, isn't critical to the plot and to the movie itself, but hey, it's fun. It's fun stuff. That's for sure.
I wish he did a little more trimming on Elizabethtown.
Okay. Wow. Yeah. I've only seen that once so far, but
I actually really like that movie.
Yeah. All right.
But I have a very definite different starting point, I think, than Cameron Crowe does.
Oh, okay. So later in the story,
I think it should start
the earliest
with Orlando Bloom's character coming home and setting up his exercise bike. I think
a couple little flashbacks to the time before what happened, kind of, or just they can just be alluded to.
Well, throughout the rest of the film, his family doesn't know why he's there.
Yeah. Wow. Okay. Yeah.
So if you were like his family, and you were wondering, well, what is the thing? And it slowly revealed to you what the fiasco was. So you're kind of getting it twice.
Wow.
I think it would have made it a bit stronger. And he probably could have left in some of the driving and music at the end, and I don't think I'd have problems with the pacing. But yeah, it's not that it's like a bad beginning, but I think it would have made the movie more compelling. Yeah.
Well, I like it because that's kind of what I went to school for. So the product design, essentially.
Right.
Choices made and so forth. I guess they can bite you in the ass. I thankfully didn't continue on with that career, well, do you think you have any more notes for this minute, or we can get to the, like I mentioned, next minute dialogue list?
I think we can probably move on.
Okay. So let us know more about your projects.
Like I said, I've got two podcasts. One is For Your Consideration, which I do with my co-host Dustin Friesenhan, where we discuss films on the Sight and Sound best greatest movies of all time list. And the other podcast is a podcast named Scooby-Doo, where I'm essentially putting together an oral history of the franchise, which has been running for 50 years and a bit at this point. And I interview people who've worked on the shows, the comic books. Basically, if you touch the franchise in some way, I'll probably hunt you down and ask you for an interview.
Yeah, that's a lot of couple really cool things that you're doing there. I've enjoyed some episodes of each. I haven't say I've gone back and tried to listen to everything yet, but maybe at some point I will. be able to.
No worries.
Love it.
And I got a couple movies by minute podcasts in the wings, so we'll see.
Wow. So speaking of which, moviesbyminutes.com is the website where you can go and see all currently, I believe we're at 190. So we're closing on 200 total different shows.
Wow.
Almost totally different. I think there's a couple that are kind of repeat-ish in there between sequels or something, or something a little weird with a couple of them. I won't name names right now, but, but so we'll be there pretty soon, I think, in the next couple of months here, sometime mid 2021, maybe, where we'll hit 200, I bet. I really appreciate the, and I just had the 3 or 4 weeks ago now, Alex Robinson on, and he and Pete the Retailer do the Star Wars Minute, podcast, which really got me in the mindset of possibly doing this, and ended up happening.
They're the granddaddies of the whole format.
Yeah. And I'll throw out that you can contact me directly, privately via email at almostfamousminute@gmail.com. And go search us out on Facebook and Twitter and what have you. We have our page and we have our group called Band-Aids Listener Society. So find all that great stuff that way. I will mention I do appreciate Harman Audio for supplying the AKG Lyra microphone that I'm currently talking into. Hopefully you've enjoyed listening via through this mic and it sounds good to you. And they even also threw in headphones, which are wonderful. Hearing how it all works through these great headphones. Thanks so much, Mike. You think you'll be able to make it back for the next minute, as I was mentioning?
I think I can move some things around.
I appreciate it. So we'll be back here in next week for minute 89. Until then, it's all happening.
It's all happening.
I am a golden god! Yeah! Yes, you
are! And I was born in the backseat of a Greyhound bus, rolling down Highway 41.
You know the Queen of Hearts is always your best bet.